listening to the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast. Hi, this is Shane Vanderhart, and welcome to our 50th episode. I apologize for the hiatus. I was traveling for work in Missouri last week, and earlier this week, I was in Kansas. This week, I wanted to introduce a new element to the podcast, Items of Interest. When we did Caffeinated Thoughts Radio, we talk about news you can use. This is a little bit similar to that. So in addition to interviews, I wanted to highlight different articles and current events and give you my two cents because everyone's entitled to my opinion, right? So coming up, more Americans say pornography is morally acceptable. Religious liberty is officially dead in Canada. President Trump says some interesting things about Kim Jong-un. And later in the podcast, I speak with Jonathan Williams, the chief economist and vice president for the American Legislative Exchange Council, who is the author of a new report ranking each governor's state of the state address and their current economic policies compared to other states. And Iowa is number three in the country, which is awesome. But on the other hand, ALEC released Rich States, Poor States Economic Outlook, and Iowa's 29th, which is not so great. But first, a word from one of our sponsors, American Principles Project.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, Project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
Last week, Gallup released a poll that shows more Americans believe in that pornography is morally acceptable. Yes, you heard that right. Morally acceptable. 43% of Americans said that they believe pornography is morally acceptable, which is at the highest level since Gallup started asking this question in 2011. This is up 7% since 2017. These results come from Gallup's annual Values and Beliefs survey that was conducted May 1st through the 10th. Andrew Duggan for Gallup writes, from 2011 onward, notable shifts in opinion are apparent for actions such as doctor-assisted suicide, gay-lesbian relations, sex between unmarried people, and having a baby out of wedlock. Until this year, though, Americans' perception regarding the morality of pornography have changed at a more modest rate than those other issues. From 2011 to 2017, the percentage of Americans who find pornography morally acceptable rose by 6 points, whereas Americans' opinions on those other issues changed by an average of 9 points. But in light of this year's 7-point shift, perceptions that pornography is morally acceptable have increased more than any of the other 16 other indicators or other behaviors or practices Gallup has measured over the time span of 2011 through 2018. More Democrats, 53%, which is a 21% increase since 2011 and up, 11% since last year, believe that's morally acceptable. That Republicans, which at 27% is an 11% increase since 2011 and up 2% since last year, believe that pornography is morally acceptable. 45% of independents say that it is morally acceptable, up 5% since 2017. And it's no surprise that the view of pornography changed the most since 2017 among young men and those who are not married. Duggan notes, this year, the percentage of non-married individuals who find pornography morally acceptable rose 15% to 50%. Acceptance of pornography among married individuals at 35% this year is substantially no different than last year's 37%. At least it went down. Meanwhile, 67% of men aged 18 to 49 this year say that pornography is morally acceptable, 14-point increase from last year. By contrast, perceptions remained relatively stable across other age gender categories, including men who are 50 or older, a 1-point increase, women aged 18 to 49, plus 4 points, and women aged 50 and older, plus 7 points. Religion makes a difference. Only 22%, up from 6 points since 2011, say that religion is very important, who say that religion is very important, believes that pornography is morally acceptable. Contrast that with those who say it is not. 76% of those Americans say pornography is morally acceptable. So with our sex-saturated culture and pornography being just a click away, this should come as no surprise. Our culture and our young people are growing more and more desensitized to it. Fight the New Drug, citing a report from Pornhub, brought to light the magnitude of this problem. For instance, enough porn was watched in 2016 on the one website that it all the data would fill 194 million USB sticks. If you put the USB sticks end to end, they'd wrap all the way around the moon. In 2017 alone, Pornhub got 28.5 billion visits. That's almost 1,000 visits a second, or 78.1 million a day, way more than the population of the entire United Kingdom. In 2016, 91,980,225,000 videos were watched on Pornhub. That's 12.5 videos for every person on the planet. Also, more than 4,599,000,000 hours of porn were watched on the site in just 1 year. That's equal to 5.246 centuries. This is incredible. This is important for Christians to keep in mind, because 1 John 2:16 tells us that for all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh and the desires of the eyes and pride of life is not from the Father, but is from the world. We need to resist this in order to be different. We have to be counted apart. And it's good that fewer who consider religion important think porn is morally acceptable, but that doesn't necessarily mean people who think it's not morally acceptable aren't watching. It's a huge problem, and we need to talk about it, and we can't afford not to discuss this and not put appropriate safeguards in place at home, at the workplace. Parents, you got to talk to your kids. The church can't afford not to discuss this as well. Because Romans 12:2 says, we're not to be conformed to this world, but to be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by the testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. And if we're inundating our minds with porn, and if it's seeping into the church culture, it's a problem. And this is something we can't, ignore. Religious liberty is now officially dead in Canada. Alliance Defending Freedom reports that the Supreme Court of Canada today dealt a major blow to religious freedom and freedom of association on Friday, ruling that law societies in Canada may deny accreditation to the Christian law school. That judgment comes after a long legal battle in several provinces. Trinity Western University, which is a school affiliated with the Evangelical Free Church of Canada, as well as the Evangelical Free Church of America. Former co-host of Caffeinate Thoughts Radio, Brian Myers, attended there. Their law school asks students and faculty to follow its community covenant based on biblical views of appropriate sexual behavior on campus. Some law societies deem the covenant discriminatory, leading to a denial of accreditation. The Supreme Court of Canada has abandoned this promise of freedom that led to the creation of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms 36 years ago. Individuals will need to turn to their legislators to protect freedom of religion, said Gerald Chipier. I'm probably pronouncing his name wrong, who is a Canadian attorney who is affiliated with ADF International. Two of the justices, Russell Brown and Suzanne Cote, I'm probably pronouncing her name wrong too, dissented, expressing the view that legislatively accommodated and charter-protected religious practices, once exercised, cannot be cited by a state actor as reason justifying the exclusion of a religious community from public recognition. Approval of their proposed, Trinity Western University's proposed law school would not represent a state preference for evangelical Christianity, but rather a recognition of the state's duty, which, in this case, the Law Society of British Columbia failed to observe to accommodate diverse religious beliefs without scrutinizing their content, unquote. The Canadian Supreme Court heard two appeals out of Ontario and British Columbia, while Alberta, Saskatchewan, Prince Edward Island, New Brunswick, the Yukon, and Nova Scotia have agreed to recognize the school's graduates. Ontario denied recognition and Trinity Western appealed. In British Columbia, the local law society appealed. The British Columbia's Court of Appeals ruled in favor of Trinity Western in Trinity Western v. the Law Society of British Columbia and stated that this case demonstrated how, quote, a well-intentioned majority acting in the name of tolerance and liberalism can, if unchecked, impose its views on the minority in a matter that is in itself intolerant and illiberal, unquote. After the Law Society appealed, the Supreme Court heard both appeals together in December 2017. Quote, religious universities and schools should be free to operate according to the faith they teach and to which they adhere, said ADF International Executive Director Paul Coleman. Quote, we are deeply disappointed with the Supreme Court's decision. Freedom of religion and association is not only essential for faith-based organizations, but for the functioning of democracy itself. Following the ruling, that vital freedom is now in jeopardy. President Charles McVitie, speaking on behalf of Canada Christian College and School of Graduate Theological Studies and Institute for Canadian Values, said, quote, we are deeply saddened that our Supreme Court would denote limiting actual religious expression as minor significance, yet referring to the virtual LGBT applicant to Trinity Western Law School as significant. Our religious freedom is not minor, and we are not second-class citizens. Our forefathers fought and died for our freedom, and we will not yield hard-fought freedoms to the nine unelected, unaccountable judges, unquote. It's important for us to keep in mind that, you know, while this is happening to our neighbors in the north, it's coming here, folks. Watch what's happening in the United Kingdom. Watch what's happening in Canada. This is what happened. Now, granted, in Masterpiece Cake Shop v. Colorado Civil Rights Commission, we had a good ruling, but this assault is going to continue, so bear that in mind. Item number three, Trump on the North Korea summit. I want to play you some audio from this morning, him meeting with different reporters on the White House lawn.
Are we close to seeing Mr. Kim here at the White House?
Could happen. I mean,
they talked about that yesterday.
I would have him. Yeah, I think it's something that could happen. Yeah. Hey, he's the head of a country, and I mean, he is the strong head. Mm-hmm. Don't let anyone think anything different.
Right.
He speaks, and his people sit up at attention. I want my people to do the
right.
same.
We now have a very good relationship with North Korea. When I came into this job, it looked like war, not because of me, but because if you remember the sit down with Barack Obama, I think he will admit this. He said the biggest problem that the United States has, and by far the most dangerous problem, and he said to me, that we've ever had because of nuclear, is North Korea. Now, that was shortly before I entered office. I have solved that problem. Now we're getting it memorialized and all. But that problem is largely solved. And part of the reason is we signed, number one, a very good document. But you know what? More importantly than the document, I have a good relationship with Kim Jong-un. That's a very important thing. I can now, I can now say, well, we have a problem. I told him, I gave him a very direct number. He can now call me if he has any difficulty. I can call him. We have communication. It's a very good thing. People are shocked that this is the kind of, you know, they thought Trump was going to get in. He was going to start throwing bombs all over the place. It's actually the opposite.
Well, but
we're building a military so strong, $716 billion next year, $700 this year. We're building a military so strong, nobody's going to mess with us. But you know what? I never want to have to use it.
Can you tell us, President Trump?
Well, like I said, President Trump had some interesting things to say. I really hope he didn't mean what he said about people. He expect people to stand at attention when he speaks. I hope that was a joke. Regarding the agreement, I've read the agreement. There's absolutely nothing new in it. There were no timetables, no measurable goals, no way to verify whether North Korea is truly working in good faith to denuclearize. There was not a promise to denuclearize. There was a promise to work towards denuclearization, whatever that means. I hope that they are. I'm not rooting for President Trump's failure here. So far, all that I've seen is that North Korea has been given a major PR coup. And we have the President of the United States who is talking up Kim like he, you know, did with these reporters today, saluting North Korean military officers, flying the U.S. flag next to North Korea's flag. President Trump has adopted their propaganda as his talking points, for instance, saying that joint military exercises with the South Koreans was provocative. It's not provocative. He called them war games. They're not war games. They're exercises, and they're actually directed towards China, not North Korea. Also, as they met as though two countries stood on the same footing, which we don't. United States is a superpower. We are the world's only superpower, and they are a gulag state. Perhaps this will be the first of many talks, and perhaps something good will come out of this. He should have withheld a meeting until there were some tangible conditions met and concessions made. The President of the United States should not have met with Kim Jong-un based on what we actually got out of this. This looks like it's going to be yet another empty promise from the North Koreans. The best I can say about it at the moment is at least he did not give them a pile of cash and agree to lift sanctions like the Obama administration did with the Iranians. But there's still time, though. That could still happen. I hope not. I hope my concern is for nothing and Trump's strategy of buttering Kim Jong-un up works. I would love to be wrong. Up next is my conversation with Jonathan Williams, the chief economist and vice president for the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. But first, a message about meeting your life insurance needs.
Hi, this is Brian Myers. When I needed a better life insurance plan, I found it with Travis Riswold of Modern Woodmen of America. When I first met Travis, he wasn't like some other life insurance agents that can be pushy and try to get you to buy something. Travis just made himself available to me. That was it. He told me to let him know if and when I needed anything, and he stayed in touch. When the day came and I did need to make some changes with my life insurance, Travis met with me and walked me through several options so I could make an informed decision. Ultimately, it was the best decision for my situation. So if you need a life insurance plan that makes sense for you, call my friend Travis Riswold with Modern Woodmen. His number is 515-883-0029. That's Travis Riswold with Modern Woodmen. He can help you find the life insurance you need. Call him at 515-883-0029.
Hey, Jonathan, welcome to the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. I appreciate you taking the time to connect with us.
Well, I appreciate you having me on, and I would like to say greetings from the land of make-believe, Washington, D.C.
I love it when I hear some like, oh gosh, I think I've heard Congressman Young say this, like, yeah, I'm going back to, you know, I go to Washington, D.C., and then I come back to America every weekend, so...
Well, you know, President Reagan, I think, had it about right. He said, Washington is an island surrounded by reality. So when you get a chance to get off that island and go back to reality, whatever state that may be, take a chance.
I've had conversations with people who have been thoroughly entrenched in the Beltway. And some of the things I hear them say, it's like, yeah, you and I, we just, you know, we just see things completely differently. I'm like, I don't hear anybody out here in Iowa talking like that. So it's a unique area, that's for sure. Well, I wanted to talk about, you had a report recently on the various state of the state addresses in 2018. And you said our governor, Reynolds' speech or state of the state address was one of the best this year. Why is that?
So, yeah, this is a report that we've now put together for the last 4 years, and because nobody else really does a comprehensive analysis of what governors are proposing. And we have analyzed nearly all governors gave addresses this year from a free market perspective. We analyze it to say who's giving the best proposals, who's giving the worst, and why. And, you know, obviously it's important to point out that these are simply proposals.
Yes.
And obviously the outcomes can be much different.
Yeah, I mean, talk could be cheap.
That's right. And we see that play out occasionally. And of course, we're more than happy to then call out governors for doing things outside of their proposals later on in the year. We have a companion publication called Tax Cut Roundup, where at the end of December, we go back and kind of hold people accountable if they propose great things and went the opposite direction, or vice versa, I guess, sometimes doing better things than they propose. But Governor Reynolds is one for one and making our best of the best list in her first State of the State, or I guess as you all say, condition of the state address, I think. And she basically was awarded that placing for a couple of reasons, to summarize up without going too far into the weeds. And you know, one is call for comprehensive pro-growth tax reform. I think that was something obviously got across the finish line. We can perhaps talk more about that later.
Oh, definitely.
There was a lot of pluses and maybe a few minuses out of that reform, but her setting the table and the way that she said it, I think, was very important. And that is, since we passed federal tax reform for the first time in 31 long years last December, Iowa, more than most other states, would have seen a tax increase at the state level if nothing was done, just because of the linkage to the federal tax code and federal deductibility. And so the way that she framed it to say, we did the right thing in Washington, we're going to see pro-growth effects from those tax cuts, but let's make sure we hold Iowa taxpayers harmless and we give them a second boost from that tax cut. So that was a great part of her speech that we like to see. And then another one that didn't get nearly as much play this session, which is talking about setting up a commission to review tax credits and to take a look at maybe looking at the effectiveness of what's currently baked into the Iowa tax code with the hope of getting rid of some of those and reducing rates in future years when you do that.
Okay, so some follow-up questions. Is there anything that she said that maybe a lot of other governors didn't? I mean, it's one thing to be one of the better condition the state's addresses, but it's another thing entirely to be the best. So, you know, what was she saying that other governors weren't?
Well, I think it was, we did see other governors talk about tax reform and how it's going to impact their states, but surprisingly, not as many as you think would. I think there's some governors, perhaps from different ideological backgrounds, that would hope that taxpayers don't know that the state will be much richer because of federal tax reform, and they hope to spend all that money and hope that the taxpayers are none the wiser. It was good to see several, if not maybe a dozen or more, governors talk about federal tax reform. However, I think she went to the next step and did that second piece of what we just talked about, which was not being content with just giving back the dollars that were coming in unexpectedly due to federal tax reform, but then taking it a step further to say, let's have a comprehensive review of our tax code. Let's look at these tax expenditures, as they say, the tax credits, deductions, things like that, that may be very politically popular, but have a very delirious effect on tax code, keeping tax rates high for everybody else across the board. And so a lot of times government picks winners and losers that way through these kind of special tax favorites. So it takes a rare governor to be able to take on some very vested political interest and say, let's maybe take a look at these. Let's make sure taxpayers are getting the best deal and let's maybe get rid of some of them at lower rates across the board. So that's what I think really put her in that next level of governors to make our best of the best.
Okay, so ALEC also released a Rich States, Poor States Economic Outlook report that lists Iowa 29th, which is a little less than inspiring. What factors go into this report and why is Iowa in the middle of the pack?
So this is the 11th edition of the Rich States, Poor States rankings that I co-author every year with Art Laffer and Stephen Moore. And we put together the ranking to give legislators and just concerned citizens across the country a way to measure their state in terms of economic competitiveness. And we look at 15 equally weighted factors in our report, everything from tax rates to tax burdens across sales, income, property taxes, levels of debt, size of government employment, minimum wage laws, right to work status, ways of keeping government spending under control. Those are all kind of the factors, tax regulation, labor policy, the three big areas that we measure. And, you know, to your point, Iowa comes in just slightly below average. And I think that is a good motivating factor as to why the legislature came together and followed the governor's lead for in her State of the State address and said, we do need to remake our tax code, because not only do we need to make sure that we hold Iowa taxpayers harmless from any unintended effect of federal tax reform because of the federal deductibility issue, we need to actually make Iowa more competitive, because we realize that states across the country are looking to attract these individuals and businesses. As we, one of our key findings in rich states, poor states, is just how much people vote with their feet or vote with their pocketbook and go from state to state. And it turns out that states with better rankings in rich states, poor states, and lower tax burdens are some of the states with the highest in-migration of businesses and individuals. So I think it was a very good point to make, to say Iowa's below average when it comes to competitiveness in our ranking, and tax reform, I think, is going to move the ball forward. Now, it's important to note that the 29th position that Iowa currently finds itself in is as of January 1st, 2018. So the tax reform that passed has not yet taken effect in the rankings, and I think it will have a pretty significant impact in moving that ranking in the right direction.
Right now, currently, Iowa's ranked 47th in the top marginal corporate income tax rate, is right around 12%. And the tax reform bill lowered that to 9.8%, which is progress, but it's still pretty high, in you know, my opinion. What rate would Iowa truly need to lower to be, you know, truly competitive?
Because I think you'd probably have to get it towards the 5 or 6% range.
Okay.
And so you've got a ways to go yet. I do know that in the tax reform package, as I understand, there's the triggers in current law now that will, based on future revenue growth, continue to buy down tax rates. And so I think that's an important piece of what was done under tax reform on the individual and business tax side. But, you know, states across the country are really looking at ways to get that cost of doing business in their state down. I mean, North Carolina, one of the best examples of pro-taxpayer reform over the last decade or two, they're in the process of continuing to phase in through revenue triggers their reform, and their tax rate on the corporate income tax is going from currently 3% down to 2.5%.
Wow.
And we've seen many other states try to get below 5. I think that's really the key, is you want to get to about the 5 or below range to be in that competitive spot when it comes to corporate taxes. So while the current reform that was passed in 2018 certainly moves Iowa in the right direction on the income tax side, you've got a ways to go, as you pointed out.
Because I was just noticing also with the income tax reform, you know, with the cut of the highest rate from before the triggers, is from 8.98% down to 8.53%, which is like, oh, okay, basically covers probably federal deductibility, maybe. If enough revenue growth is realized, as you mentioned, the triggers in the state in future years, which is about $8.3 billion, is the trigger they want to hit by fiscal year 2022, which would amount to basically 4% growth each fiscal year. A lot of us are thinking, we've yet to see revenue grow that much. So I know a lot of us thought that trigger is probably too high, but even so, if we do happen to hit it, and I hope we do, tax rates that'll be reduced further, with the top individual rate reduced again to 6.5%, and reduce the number of tax brackets from 9 to 4. One thing I noticed, when that trigger hits and they reduce the top bracket to 6.5% and then reduce the number of tax brackets, it'll also eliminate federal deductibility. But the final cut of the top individual rate will still be higher than what it is now with federal deductibility, according to your report anyway. You know, I don't think it's being aggressive enough. What are your thoughts?
Well, obviously, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool tax reformer who likes to see low tax rates and competitive economies. And so my answer is always go as low as you absolutely can while providing core government services, right? And so I think that absolutely almost all states could go lower on their rates. I think it's important to say it's directionally correct in getting the net tax burden down by something in the order of $2 billion over the next 6 years, as I understand. So, I mean, that's an important move in the right direction. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I understand it was the largest net tax reduction since something like the late 90s.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it's important to say it's a good step, but there's more that needs to be done. And, you know, talking with some of our great ALEC legislative leaders, Linda Utmeyer and Charles mm-hmm. Snyder and others, I know there's commitment to continue to try to make Iowa more competitive. And, you know, let's hope that between tax reform and other things happening federally, that this economy continues to stay red hot. And that's going to only do things like put more resources in the hands of state policymakers to then utilize it to do good things for their economy when they come into session in 2019.
And another thing that jumped out at me, looking at the report, and I didn't realize this, we were ranked 41st in the number of government employees per 10,000 people at 588. First of all, does that include teachers?
Yeah, that's state and local employees, okay. Full-time equivalent. So that is a problematic ranking. And what it is obviously a proxy for size of government.
Right.
And sometimes to the extent of the states that have a fairly large rural population, that there is a little bit of a skewing. You get a bit of an unfair shake on this because obviously there's some core services that need to be provided regardless of population density.
Right.
But nonetheless, going in the bottom 10 in that category, even with large rural population, is something to certainly take a look at to say why is Iowa that far out of whack when it comes to the rest of the country, looking at size and scope of government employment.
Right. Well, you know, I one of the criticisms that the left directed towards Governor Branstad before he resigned to become ambassador to China was, you know, he was working on trying to cut down the size of government, even though spending, you know, our budget kept on increasing and spending kept on increasing. But there were programs he eliminated, and he was constantly badgered about it. And I'm just wondering, where can Iowa, especially when we, do need teachers, we do need police officers, we do need firefighters, where are a lot of states that are doing well, where are they cutting, the fat, I guess? What have you seen?
Well, in some cases, it's going to take a comprehensive review and performance audits of state government to say, where does that exist? And each state is a bit different where some of that is hidden. And some states certainly have more fat to the budget than others. I'm thinking
right.
of neighbors like Illinois and,
yeah.
and maybe Minnesota and states like that in the region that probably have a lot more of looking to do for low-hanging fruit when it comes to that area. But I think it's not unique in Iowa that education and healthcare spending take up such a large percentage of the budget. It's almost like a scenario analogous to in Washington, D.C., where we have Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, of all of these non-discretionary items that when budget reformers come to the table and say, what can we do to reverse the course of government spending? All of a sudden, they find out their hands are tied and there's very little discretionary to work with. So I think that if you were to take those things off the table, there's almost no savings in some areas. So I think it's probably incumbent on a lot of states to say, yes, we've held K-12 and higher ed constant. And we haven't addressed some of that spending growth over the years, and maybe mm-hmm. for good reason. But how about things like school choice? How about
yeah.
things that make the delivery of public education focused on the students and the families, and instead of funding institutions and worrying about the inputs and the cost per pupil, let's talk about the outcomes and funding students and funding families to make those decisions. I think it's going to take a paradigm shift
right.
When it comes to education before you see some real savings.
Well, yeah, people could, we get complaints about, hey, we're not funding K-12 public education enough. We're not funding our regent universities enough. And I'm like, that budget is growing every year. Now, some of it's obviously because of the number of students enrolled. But, I suggested one thing and you would have thought was suggesting that we just not educate our kids at all. And that's like, why does Iowa need? Why do we need three Regents universities? Why not just two? and minds exploding of people couldn't, like, what? Who'd you cut?
Well, and also, I mean, one of the areas that quite honestly is over time, unless it's addressed, going to continue to rob dollars from classroom. And this is a big thing nationally, as we've seen the explosion of budgets when it comes to K-12. But when you look at the dollars that are actually making it to the classroom, that continues to be a problematic. And that's
right.
A lot of non-classroom
right.
employees that are taking the administrators and the building costs and things like that. But another one is pension costs. And this is something that the unfunded liabilities in public pensions nationally, I think, are the existential threat to state finances for the next generation. And my case in point is your neighbors in Illinois. Of course, we've seen that in the headlines, and of course, Chicago. And so the scenario that's played out in Chicago now is where out of the last 5 years, and actually this is statewide, 89 cents of every new dollar for public education in Illinois has gone to pension costs and not to teachers, not to the classrooms, not to textbooks or all the other things we're told that we need more money for. So I think your point of kind of exposing the myth of baseline budgeting, which is people say they want more, they don't get what they want, so they say that's a cut to education, versus you look at the overall spending year over year, and we're seeing it go up. And of course, the efficiency discussion is lacking from the debate so many times.
Yes. Yeah. Another thing I noticed with the report, and it kind of floored me, we're 50th in the state inheritance tax that's levied. First of all, it's a tax I never hear anybody talk about. Why are we dead last?
Well, so this is a bit of a quirk in the report. It's not a 1 through 50 in the sense of many other variables.
Oh, okay.
It's a yes or no binary variable. So either you have a tax on the books or you don't, and it's a 1 or a 50 ranking. And so I actually remember talking to Governor Branstad about this last time I was in his office before he headed to China. And of course, he's one of the ALEC founders from 1973 when he was a state legislator. And he pointed out to me that he thought it was unfairly treated in the report on that piece. But, you know, nonetheless, Iowa does have one on the books. I think it's run through the local governments, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
And it's maybe a fairly low amount of people that it affects. But our point is that death taxes, whether they're locally administered or state administered, have a horrible track record. They hurt economic competitiveness, and a lot of times they chase away wealthy individuals when they're near retirement, looking for not just better weather climates, but to avoid taxes like that so they can pass along a nest egg for their kids or their grandkids.
And frankly, I think it's theft, because that money's already been taxed.
Yeah, once or twice at least.
Yeah.
So it could be the third time of tax. So, I mean, it's a fundamentally immoral tax, I think, to your point. And it's just something that probably on a dynamic basis raises little to no money because of all the out-migration that it precipitates to places like Florida and Texas, states that don't tax income either. And, of course, they don't have death taxes on the books.
All right. Just last question is where does Iowa go from here? And maybe there's something that we haven't talked about you wanted to address.
So I think that the tax reform that's passed will move Iowa in the right direction, probably get you into the top half of states. That's, I think, fairly easy to predict when it gets into next year's ranking. Mm-hmm. I think, obviously, as we discussed, more needs to be done to continue to chip down personal and corporate income tax rates. I think something that we just discussed on the death tax is low-hanging fruit to make Iowa more competitive in a very small revenue loss. And then I think it really is a question of addressing the elephant in the room on the pension liabilities. So many states have now moved in the right direction over the last 3 or 4 years, even towards the 401k style defined contribution plan, at least for new hires. We're talking about preserving the current system for retirees, so not taking away anyone's pension, preserving the system probably for vested employees as well. So anybody that's expecting to get a pension will get a pension, and then transitioning new hires into a 401k style system. You know, by the way, the private sector went to 20 or 30 years ago, and it's served well, and it served new employees well. And we have all these millennials coming into the workforce who are not going to stay for 40 years with one employer like their parents or their grandparents' generation.
Right.
And they want flexibility, and 401k type plans give those young workers the flexibility they want. And of course, they protect taxpayers. And then will, that's the kind of thing that needs to happen to ensure that the money is there to honor the promises to current retirees and current workers. So I think the big picture item is continue down the road of tax reform and then kind of look at ways to get to this massive unfunded liability problem before it gets to the situation like Illinois is facing right now.
All right. Well, hey, Jonathan, thank you so much for your time and have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
All right. Take care.
All right.
Bye. That was Jonathan Williams, the chief economist and vice president for the American Legislative Exchange Council. And I'm Shane Vanderhart. Thank you so much for listening. If you happen to be listening to this podcast somewhere other than on our website, please be sure to check out caffeinatedthoughts.com. That's CAFFEINATED, caffeinatedthoughts.com, or Google Caffeinated Thoughts, and we'll show up at the top of your search screen. Also, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and sign up for our emails so you don't miss a single article. Also, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Be sure to give us 5 stars. You can listen to us on Google Play, Podbean, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. If you're not a subscriber, be sure to subscribe as you don't want to miss a single episode. And you can listen to us using your favorite podcast app on your mobile phone or iPad or tablet or even on your computer. Hey, until next time, my friends, take care and have a great weekend.